So, Chuck, tell me a little bit about your background and why you wrote this book and collaborated with some others to put it together.
Yeah, three of us got together, and we sort of met one, Phil Hubbard and I, in Miami, Florida. He was an assistant public defender in the 60s, and I was a prosecutor, and we litigated against each other, and we became friends. So we would battle during the day and then go out for a beer in the evening and eventually ride bikes. That was in the 60s. Subsequently, he went on the bench after being the public defender, and I went on the bench after being a teacher and professor and prosecutor and all that. And we were used to listen to these audio tapes of what was then called the Great Teacher Series, which was a national thing, and it's obviously still around. And we heard this guy, Dennis Dalton, and we were jealous. This guy was so good. And so what we did was we eventually dropped him a letter, Phil did, and that was probably 12 or 14 years ago. And so Dennis became a friend. So the three of us got together and said, well, we're concerned about a major problem in America, which we think is going to get even worse as time goes on, and that is the distribution of wealth and income in America, where we are and where we are likely to go. And at that time, there were still a lot of people who were unaware or denied the idea that, A, there was this growing inequality in America, and B, whether or not it made any difference. And there were some people who said, well, that's a good thing. Then there were other people who said, yes, we can see it, but really don't see it as a major problem. And so what we decided to do was to write something. And the question is, what to write? Well, since the three of us were not then household names, and we did not expect after the publication of this book, modestly how we thought it great it might be, that we were not likely to become household names, short of getting arrested for something. In any case, so the idea was that rather than us write a book about these issues, that we would plumb our respective areas of expertise, none of which included economics, and prepare do an anthology so that it would not be us who would be speaking, but the people that we selected to come up with the ideas, developing the history of income and wealth distribution and maldistribution. And so the way it kind of divided up naturally is Dennis Dalton taught political science and political theory at Barnard, mainly to undergraduates, and a great lecturer. He's also a world-renowned Gandhi scholar who not only teaches Gandhi, but he lives it and carries on his life as an upper-middle-class American in that way. Phil Hubbard became the elected public defender and then eventually went on the Court of Appeals in South Florida, wrote the seminal one-volume work on search and seizure, primarily for the legal community. He subsequently went and took all the letters from his great-grandfather, who was a Civil War private and who fought in almost every major battle, and he wrote together a little book of his father's letters, wow. Great-grandfather's letters.
That must have been awesome.
Right. And now he's writing a book about a very famous trial in which two black men were beaten and sentenced to death in the Florida state system. So he's still in there doing the writing. So the idea that was that we would do an anthology. Dennis, by nature, since he was teaching the Greeks and then through Rousseau and Marx and Lenin to eventually his most beautiful lectures deals with his take on and compares Gandhi and Hitler. And it's worth listening.
I'll bet.
So if you Google Dennis Dalton, and you can find that in the Great Teacher Series. In any case, so Dennis really focused primarily on that being his background. Phil and I did a lot of the data collection with some help to try to develop what in fact was happening in America in terms of the distribution of wealth and also income. And so, because at that time, as I say, there were some people who were denying that it was going on or was a problem. And so we have footnotes up to 2014. And since we have an electronic edition, I will eventually be updating with new data. And of course, there's so much of it now. What started as a torrent is now a tsunami. So a lot of what the book is addressed to is what concepts have people had about wealth and income distribution, and second, what to do about it. And broadly, if you go through history, we've sort of tried to narrow it down to two essentially great and somewhat opposing schools of thought. One, of course, is the traditional, what we would call a conservative, which is the idea of limited government, free markets, and so forth. And in our book, we have some quotes from the great thinkers of those theories, and then we have footnotes which will lead people and linked into pulling up more stuff. Because obviously now, a footnote is not what a footnote used to be.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so the next one, of course, is what people broadly call the liberal way of looking at the world. And so we have the great thinkers and also those of lesser lights on the idea of government and government intervention, regulation, and so forth. The third one is we have people from the farther to the right and farther to the left. So what we try to do is cover the political spectrum from left to right, with identifying who are the principal writers and speakers, and then who are maybe the next level down. And then this book is a 260-page access into this world. So what it means is that we've already done a lot of the preliminary work so that people can use the book to get a better understanding of what the other side, if you look at it that way, is thinking. Ultimately, the message of the book is really clear. Unless we can sit and break bread together, unless we can have a civil conversation, not that we love each other, because it's really easy to hate someone and to make an enemy out of them, but it takes real courage to sit down with someone who's telling you something you really don't want to hear. And that's what we have to say, because if we don't do that, here's where we're going. Right now, a third of the people on Social Security, that is their entire income. And the average payment is about $13,000 a year for a single person. So what it means is that people who are retiring now on Social Security, they are below the poverty line for a single person. What it means is that all that we did to bring the seniors, including me, of course, and my co-authors, is that what we've done is to take the generation of people before we made sure that being old didn't mean being poor. Because what people don't understand is, guess what, folks? If we don't fix this, when your grandparents are retired and they don't have any money, guess where they're going to be living? With you.
Yep, and when we all have dementia.
And we all have, some of us, hopefully.
Some of us.
Now, what's happened right now is that about 61% of retired Americans, their income is half or is about half or less. And so it's about half on Social Security and half on other forms of income. The only problem is that for a lot of people, the value of their housing has gone down. A lot of people have still not recovered from 2008. And the principal savings that most Americans have, to the extent they have any, is tied up in their real estate. The other part of it, since we're a nation that doesn't save anymore, and there have been numerous articles, and I mentioned a couple in our promotion of the book, it was a couple of articles which indicated that if people who have an income of $100,000 a year, if something happens and they can't come up with $1,000 to pay for a car repair without going into debt. And so what it is, we have a people whose 401ks have not panned out because the guy who designed the 401k said this is a supplement to Social Security. It's not supposed to be in lieu of it. So what we are confronting is a generation in which, as people retire, they don't have any money and they can't afford to live independently. At the same time, we have somewhere around 6 million people in the United States that have some serious form of dementia. And for a lot of those people, because we're able to keep the body going longer, it means that whereas people with dementia years ago might have lived for a year or two, being completely unable to take care of themselves, is that we're going to have more and more people who not only have dementia and need 24/7 care, but they're going to be living longer and needing that care. And you go through the fact that we have an infrastructure, whether it's, I mean, you don't get elected passing a sewer bond.
No, never
right?
have.
Okay. The other part of it is the only time you can make an improvement on the water plant is when you can't drink the water anymore. So we have all of these problems that have been festering now for all of these years, and we've not, because of the gridlock at the national level, we've not been able to address them.
And we were talking earlier, you mentioned that where you live, you're able to talk to people about this. You're able to have civil conversations with people you disagree with, sometimes disagree with mightily. But you're concerned, and one of the reasons for this book is that people can't talk anymore, that we become enemies and we can't talk about just who we are, or we can't even get along with people we disagree with.
Well, that's true. And the thing about it is that some of us up there, we have an agreement when we first moved up there.
And up there is Nederland.
Is Nederland.
Okay.
Right. That's, I call that real civilization. You know, we don't do shootouts at the Pioneer Inn anymore, but we do some of that verbally.
There you go.
Right? And so some of us have an agreement that we decided that we prefer to develop relationships without getting into things political or religious. There are others of us who we'll basically, we're like-minded, and so we'll go off in our corner, and then we'll get in our cave and echo to each other. which is a lot of what conversation goes for these days,
yep.
As we divide ourselves up by camp, by zip code, and then we do an internecine warfare. But there's some of us there who, and the thing about it is, everything is centered around the thing which has always kept humanity together, a warm fire, good drink, and food.
Amen.
Amen. And that's one of the things when I was a kid growing up. And I remember one of my first memories is when we had one of the first TV sets on the block, and it had a really big wooden box and a really small screen, and it was black and white.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, not a whole lot bigger than your iPod. So anyway, I remember when the technician turned on the screen, and there was Harry Truman riding in 1949 to get inaugurated as his first full term as President of the United States. But in those days, as angry as people were, Tip O'Neill and the people on the other side of the aisle could sit down and break bread together. Now, if you do that, you're considered a traitor.
So how did that happen, do you think? What changed over time? Because you've lived, you said, since Truman and Dewey till now. What happened to us?
That's really complicated. But I would say one of the things is an overload of media. And that is, it's, and there have been a number of books written on the influence of the internet and so forth. One of the books is entitled Shallows, and it almost got the Pulitzer Prize. And the author talks about how what we do now is that a lot of our thought patterns are very quick, very fast-paced. We're constantly inundated with stimuli and stimuli from all over the place. And consequently, our attention span gets shorter and shorter and shorter. The second thing is that there was a period of time in which public service and good governance, particularly in the 50s and 60s, was considered a good place for intelligent people to go, not coining money on Wall Street or anywhere else. So that was a career in public service, or if in the private sector, something that was connected with something other than making money at any cost. So there's that part of it. A third part of it is We've had not just racial segregation, we have socioeconomic segregation. And so what we have is people who really don't understand what it's like to walk in someone else's moccasins. I mean, there are people in my town in Miami, where I've spent a good part of my adult life, they won't drive through the black section because they're afraid, let alone walk on the street. And so what we've done is we've locked ourselves up. I mean, like when I hear the subdivisions, well, you can do such and such a subdivision for $300,000 to $500,000, or you can go the $500,000 to $800,000. So we're increasingly segregating ourselves from being able to understand what life is really like for people, other people. And the bottom line is, human beings, we survive on empathy. Because if we cannot understand even a little bit how the world looks to someone else, then that further reinforces our American ethos of individualism. And individualism, which if you go back to Adam Smith, he was a Presbyterian minister. And he wrote a book on morals 25 years before he wrote the big one, right?
Before the invisible hand.
Before the invisible hand, right. That's why I've had a problem. I've been looking for the invisible hand, and I haven't found it yet. But in any event, and so the idea is that people who grew up with our founders like Madison and Hamilton, they were really nervous about democracy because they knew the word democracy came from the Greek word demos, which is mob. And so you and I, ordinary citizens, we are the demos that they were to a certain extent afraid of. But on the other hand, they understood that if you weren't at least able to have some common discourse. And remember, we've always been a passionate people. So that's why the Greeks understood why they needed the golden mean, because without it, they'd have gotten destroyed sooner than they did.
Yep.
And so what we've forgotten how to do is we've forgotten that our heritage is we go to war with each other because we were a nation born in war with each other.
But we come back together.
But we come back together.
And now that seems to be in question.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I do know this. If we don't come back together, we're done. Now, the question is, I don't think we're the first ones to say things aren't good right now. Nor are that we really need to be able to talk to each other. The question is, how do we do that? I want to take you one of my favorite books, Persig's book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, right?
Yep, that was a classic.
That was a classic, and it's translated into 40 languages. It still is. And one of the things he said is that in order to do anything, you have to start with the one-on-one. So there is a trickle-up as well as a trickle down. So it means that on our individual daily basis, we have to do the unthinkable. We have to court views that are different than ours. And part of my life is on the internet, and I have 15 or so right wing of various stripes of blogs and so forth, and 15 or so on the left. And you know what you find when you do that? They're all different. And we have a tendency in our language, being what it is we create these tight categories. And when you call someone a conservative, what does that really mean? Well, if you look at red state and you look at some of the other, you know, town hall and some of the others on the right, is you find that there are a lot of differences among people who call themselves conservatives. And we won't speak of the fractured left. Because that's our nature.
What
right?
left?
What left? what left is left?
What is left of the
what
left?
What is left is the left. So what it means is that at least on an individual level, we've got to at least make the attempt, even if we can't carry on a conversation with someone, we can at least listen to what they have to say. The second thing is, rather than get mired in our own little environment, we need to get out of it. That's one of the reasons why my wife and I like to travel. We went to the Kingdom of Bhutan. Those people are real Buddhists. They actually live like that. And for them, they practice Buddhist economics, in which is the important thing about economics is that you get out of your own ego and you work with other people. You create something of value, And so what it is that the idea of Buddhist economics is not purely the pursuit of profit. It's about developing yourself, developing your relationships, and create something of value for those who are around you. And so, I mean,
doesn't sound like enlightened self-interest or the individual pursuit of profit, and that on the bigger scale, it'll all take care of itself. It's a whole different way to see it.
Right. And there are people who believe very firmly, and still, and you can read that in a lot of the so-called conservative literature, in that there's still a lot of people who believe in that, and those are their beliefs. But that, and sometimes, I hate to say that, sometimes they even get it right.
Sure, yeah.
But that's a real hard thing for a lot of people, including me. I mean, I was a prosecutor, I was a trial lawyer, and combat comes kind of naturally. and being a former judge, I was opinionated then and still am now. So,
but you have empathy, you have compassion, you're able to talk with other people, and you're sort of, that's disappearing or disappeared in a lot of ways in our culture.
Well, you know, for 3 years in Miami, Florida, I handled most of the termination of parental rights cases in which parents had done bad things to their kids. And it got to the point after a while they lost their kids. And I sat on those cases and I listened to all that. And some people would say how horrible they are. And I said, yes, they did some terrible things. And I'm not condoning what they did. On the other hand, I've got to understand why they've done what they've done and to say, what can we learn from this so that we don't have to have this much interfamily mayhem?
Yeah.
And so part of it comes from, you know, it's funny, when I was getting ready to go on a bench, and I was feeling pretty good about it. I never expected to do anything like that and never really looked for it. So a couple of colleagues of mine said, took me aside and said, let me understand what the roots were about. I said, what's that? I said, you're going to start off in small claims. And for $6, someone can file a complaint for a $100 lawsuit. And for $4, they can get service on the other party. So for $10, they got 20 minutes of your time, whether you like it or not. And so after a while, you spend a lot of time listening to a lot of people. And that's what we really need to do on an individual level, is to start there.
And you think the book, and from what I've seen of it, will help us do that. It's a resource of thinking about economy that will help us talk to those who we disagree with.
It gives us a common language.
There you go, yeah.
It gives us a common set of concepts, and it's none of the stuff we made up. These are the people who thought it and wrote about it, and we have quoted some of it in the book, and we have referenced it to elsewhere. So what this book is able to do, you can get people from any different side of the perspective. We take no positions in the book about what to do. We don't presume to do that. I mean, we do, of course, but we don't do it in the book, and we don't put our book out as giving the answers. What we say is, gives you a common language. You can read the parts of this that you think that are not just what you think and support what you think, but the people who have thought and written about things that you disagree with. So that at least it gives you a common language. And without a common language, communication is impossible. So this is, in a way, a book about the language of our past, our present, and hopefully our future.
You mentioned that you're writing a new introduction or a new preface based on the election last week. What will that new preface say?
I think what we're looking at is, it is exactly that. Because we did not focus on, we need to talk with each other. We need to explore a little bit more and flesh out what it will take for us to be able to do that. The second thing is, we're all former teachers, and Phil and I still teach, and so does Dennis. We're going to be doing a student guide so that we're going to provide some materials that can be used in the classroom. So what we're headed then is to say, okay, what are some ideas, which I've just started to flesh out now, of how we actually implement the idea of being able to carry on a conversation with each other. But it all starts with what's in the book now. And this book, in a sense, I would never use the word timeless. but most of the material here has been the foundation of Western thought since 500 B.C. And it carries through the Enlightenment. It carries through the period in which we're in now. And since we have an electronic edition, I'm hoping I'll be able to do a little bit of updating as time goes on. So the idea is, this is a beginning point for the conversation that we believe people need to have. And whether you like Paul Krugman or somebody on the other side of going back, you know, to Mr. Invisible Hand and so forth, they're all there. The big ones, the ones who are a little bit lesser lights, and if you take a look with me at the table of contents. The title of the book is To Form a More Perfect Union, an anthology of American values and a debate on income and wealth distribution. I think our dedication says it in five lines where we're coming from. Dedicated to our grandchildren and to their children and to their children's children. May they enjoy an America of freedom and equality.
Amen. And I can see that that's emotional for you. I mean, that touches your soul on a very deep level.
Absolutely. And then on the next page, the two quotations that probably every American learned how to recite in first grade, and some of us still remember it, is Thomas Jefferson's from the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the next one, of course, is the lines that I need not quote here, are Abraham Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address. And so this is kind of our introduction. And if you go through it, the core of the book, you can get some sense of it by reading the introduction, which kind of lays out the plan for the book, what you can expect to be reading. And then in chapter 9, we get to the very end, which is the conclusion, which then goes back to and summarizes what each of the preceding chapters have covered. And then, of course, within each chapter has his own separate set of footnotes. And the chapter 2 is the philosophical background, and we go through ancient Athens, Locke, Rousseau, and Rich. Questions raised by the Western democratic tradition. Chapter 3 is the American experience. We go through the core documents that frame us, starting with the Declaration of Independence and so forth. And then we go through the folks, you know, Madison, Henry, Tom Paine, the Federalist Papers, and we get to Learned Hand. Chapter 4 takes us from the American Revolution through the 19th, 20th, and early 21st century. Then we go into the debate on addressing our economic principles. Chapter 5 is the conservative market approach, and Chapter 6 is recent conservative thinkers on the economy. Chapter 7 is the liberal government intervention approach, and Chapter 8 are prominent recent liberal thinkers on the economic situation. And then Chapter 9, as I say, is a summary. And the whole book was originally 400 pages. We tried to cut it down into something that was a little bit more manageable and provided a lot of links and a lot of footnotes so that people can pursue their own individual research. So this is a primer. This is a foundation for people to build on it what they wish.
Let me ask you a final question. To form a more perfect union, I know Obama has mentioned that many times. It seems now, in light of the recent election, that certainly our union is not doing real well, and we're not forming a more perfect union, but maybe we are. Are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic in your life, having written this book? Do you think we can still make a more perfect union, or what do we need to continue to try to make it more perfect?
Well, I would say, quoting my wife, I'm a pessimist. I would say, in my own view, I like to be thought as a realist. I don't know. I think it depends on what we do now. And there are some people who want to go to the barricades. And I think we need to be prepared to do that, whichever side you're on. But that's, then there's the other side of it. We need to be able to listen. And to the extent we can listen, even though we're girding for warfare, and warfare we will do. And we've always done it.
Yep.
It's part of who we are.
Part of the American tradition.
It's American. But the other part of the American tradition is at some point we say, we're in this thing together. And if you read David Hackett Fisher's book, Fairness and Freedom, and David Hackett Fisher was a renowned historian, kind of an eclectic guy, had his ticket punched, got his Pulitzer, whatever you got to do to be a historian these days. And he fell in love with New Zealand, which is an easy thing to do. And he took a sabbatical and he went over there. And this book, I learned more about American history by reading David Hackett Fisher's book. And it gave me a framework to see where we're at. The other thing is, what he says is in America, we've always felt that freedom was the critical thing and fairness was secondary. In New Zealand, it's exactly the other way. Fairness, being together, is a higher value than freedom to do what you want pretty much when you want it. We land, and by the way, they just had another earthquake, a 7.8 on the Richter scale.
Yeah, I saw that.
You saw that right outside of Christchurch. We landed in Queenstown the day the earthquake hit in Christchurch in 2011.
Wow.
And we saw a nation that pulled together and stayed together. I mean, for example, in the morning, the elected public officials that were appointed ones who were responsible to try to fix things, they would have a press conference, and they were not running for office. They were not selling anything. They said, I represent so-and-so, this department, or I'm in this police department, or I'm head of waterworks, and here's what we're going to do today to try to cope with this terrible tragedy. And then in the evening, they would get together, and they would say, this is what we did. Mm-hmm. And so I remember when we were over in the west coast of the South Island, and which was now about probably 3 weeks after the earthquake. And we bumped into this woman, and she looked very, very distraught. And I said, is there anything we can do for you? And she says, I feel terribly guilty. I said, really? She said, yes, I'm from Christchurch. And I had been preparing for this holiday, which is their word for vacation, right? For a long time, and my neighbor said, you've already helped us to try to deal with this terrible earthquake. Go on holiday. Mm. And she said, I have, but I feel terribly guilty. I should be with them.
Yeah.
That's what we need.
That's what we need. Chuck Edelstein, thank you very much. We appreciate you and your book, and it's called To Form a More Perfect Union, an Anthology of American Values and the Debate on Income and Wealth Disparity. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.